Coming up in This Week in Computer Hardware, building a Steam Cache server, a 49-inch FreeSync 2 monitor from Samsung, early OnePlus 6T, Deets Surface Hub 2, and Corsair's 1000D, 18 fans, 4 radiators, and a whole lot of case. All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 466, recorded May 17th, 2018. Cashing your Steam habit in.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by the Ring Video Doorbell. Stop crime before it happens and help make your neighborhood safer with Ring. Go to ring.com/twitch and get up to $150 off of a Ring of Security kit. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/twit.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twit's weekly show that aims to bring you the fastest, most high-speed, intense, brain-crushing news about hardware, desktops, laptops, mobile, consoles, occasionally even Hyperloop commentary, although we will restrain ourselves from future transportation systems. On this episode, we will be talking primarily about computational technology as used by you, beloved listener and viewer. I'm Patrick Norton, joined as always by Mr. Ryan Schrout.
Hello.
Who is eagerly awaiting the Hyperloop installation in Florence, his hometown.
I think it's pretty much second or third on the list.
It should be.
On their list.
Yeah. I remember, when that second round of, places was announced, like after LA, it was Florence. The crushing need for high-speed transportation.
For one guy who's tired of being in the car.
I'm a little giddy right now. GPUs are really a biscuit away from MSRP, which means I can finally build my mini ITX build.
Can you define that measure of distance?
A biscuit? Well, the first time I heard it was referring to a football player who was a biscuit under 300 pounds. And in the vernacular of my childhood, which mixes weird stuff from New Jersey, the Midwest, and surfing, it just means a very small amount. In this case, about $40. From $50 or $60.
It's
bucks.
A pricey biscuit, but I get it.
It's a pricey biscuit. It's a boutique biscuit. May be a basket of boutique biscuits. Given that I nearly bought a sub 215 millimeter 1060 for what now seems like an outrageous $579, but when I was looking at it was $300 below the peak price I saw it for. Being in that $300 range is pretty sweet. So
it's a pretty drastic difference.
It's kind of crazy. I mean, it's not kind of crazy. We watch the prices climb, and we've watched the prices fall. And I got a couple of questions actually from personal friends and some viewers, all of which are like, "Are they going to go back up? Can I wait?" And I'm like, "Well, no, we didn't expect them to go up the first time."
True.
It's not like Ryan and I were sitting around going, we told you memory was going to get expensive because, people who buy memory for a living were telling us, "Hey, if you need memory, get it now because the wheels are going to fall off this year." And we were like, "Okay, the wheels are going to fall off. Everybody buy memory." And then 6 months later, memory was twice as much. With GPUs, it was just like, "Wait, where did the GPUs go?" Oh, Ethereum mining. People who think they're going to mine Bitcoin. Even though they can't. Well, they can. It'll just take several lifetimes to actually get something out of it. But it's pretty crazy to look at the price spike in December and where it is now. In any case, I'm delighted. Look at that. 3 gigabyte GTX 1060s down to $230 new 6 gigabytes. So they're anywhere between $300 and $360, depending on how fancy you're getting. Also, on a completely random note, it's amazing the performance bump between a 1050 and a 1060 and between a 1060 and a 1070. It just seems...
Yeah, they're pretty sizable gaps there.
Huge. Like, I was looking at that, and I was like, the 1050 versus 1060, 1060 versus 1070. And by the 1070 to the 1080, the financial impact, the VIG, is a little brutal. But
yeah. Remember, there is a 1050 Ti that sits between the 50 and the 60 model as well. Right. So, yeah.
It was interesting. In any case, before I meander any farther from our scheduled conversation today, you guys built something really interesting, which you do quite often at PC Per. It's funny because there's a link to the Samsung C49 HG90, which is a terrifyingly wide monitor. And I will honestly say that I am jealous of Ken getting to review it. Should we talk about that first, since that's the link that comes up, or should we talk about something I think is kind of fascinating? Because you guys built a Steam Cache server.
Let's talk about the Steam Cache server first. It's on the list earlier. Let's just do that. Let's just be sane about it, I guess. So this is an interesting problem, right? And it's for a specific class of user. It's either somebody who you have to be somebody who installs games a lot. Either you install them a lot, maybe you live in a multi-gamer dwelling, if you will, or you host LAN parties semi-frequently, or you host LAN parties very often.
Right.
Or you're like us, where you benchmark games all day and always on new successive systems. So the interesting setup for this is that when we first got our gigabit fiber internet connection here at the office, we were able to download from Steam at pretty close to 100 megabytes per second over that a couple of times, right?
Right.
And so that was as fast as our gigabit network in the office would go anyway, more or less. So downloading it and copying it off to the network attached storage device didn't make a whole lot of sense because it still had to do this like unpacking and reinitialization and stuff anyway. So it was actually faster to download it directly from Steam. Over the course of the last couple of years, what's happened is the speed we get from Steam has dropped, and it's not our internet connection. And it is probably some combination of their desire to maybe, you know, save some money, throttle people back a little bit. But there's also been a pretty high influx in CPU utilization on Steam. If you've noticed, what appears to be happening is that the security encoding, the encryption coming through of that data is more intense than it was previously. So it's actually a CPU bottleneck to download at really high speeds from these systems in many
cases. That just sounds profoundly irritating.
It is, right? For the entirety of my life, essentially, the internet has been the bottleneck for every interaction I have with the internet. And now it was no longer the case. So we had seen results, you know, go from that 100 megasecond down to, you know, sometimes 50, but a lot of times in the teens or the 20s megabytes per second. And it was like, okay, this was kind of be an interesting project. We had played with this once before, you know, several months ago. It had some stability issues where we couldn't figure out what the software exactly configuration needed to look like. And now we had another reason to do it because we had upgraded much of our internal network to 10 gigabit. So now all of a sudden, you know, if we could get those bottlenecks out of the way, we could really move things forward. So the idea is fairly simple. You have like a Docker container essentially that you have on the server, the complicated part is your IP or your DNS kind of has to filter through it. You can either do that through manual configuration of a host file, basically, so that all of the Steam CDNs point to this local server first instead of to the actual Steam servers. You can see it there. It's all at steamcache.net. It's all free, open source for you to download and try and mess around with. So the idea is pretty simple. Once you have a PC on this network and you have set up the DNS correctly, the first time you download a game through that setup, it will download it from Steam as if you normally would. So the speed would be whatever the slow rate that you're able to get before. And the next time you install that on another machine or on that machine again, it's already been cached on the Steam cache itself. And you'll max out whatever your network capability is. In our case, we were using a QNAP device that allowed us to put a VM on there and run this. We had a 10 gigabit NIC in it. It's a Ryzen 7 powered QNAP NAS, a 6-bay NAS. I think we ended up with two 1 terabyte Samsung 840 Evo SATA SSDs in RAID 0. So 2 terabytes of cache that we were able to use with this. And the result is we hit about 250 megabytes per second of downloads on there. And actually, the bottleneck appears to be server side. When you downloaded about 250 megs per second, the Ryzen 7 1700 CPU seems to be maxing out a single thread of the processor. So again, another bottleneck other than network speed, because we know our 10 gigabit network could actually exceed that performance. It's a really interesting project. The average gamer who's at home and plays games on Steam has no need for this, because you're not downloading the game multiple times, or if you are,
right,
and you should probably look at what your usage models are. But if you run a LAN party and you're going to have 10 guys over or 30 people over, whatever it's going to be at school or something, it might be worth setting one of these up, putting it on the network, and then people who show up don't have a game installed or have, the other reason you might do this is if you had a really small SSD and you were constantly flipping back and forth between games, you would uninstall a couple so you could reinstall a couple and cycle that through. This would speed up that process to some degree. But, you have to have hardware for it. You have to have, a fairly sizable cache in order to do it. So it's not an easy decision to make. But for us, it made sense because we might have 4 machines a day come online that need to have a bunch of games tested on them. So this sped things up quite a bit.
I don't have to load Steam games onto machines often enough, but I will say it never ceases to amaze me how irritating that is. Even when it's moving fast.
Yeah, it's one of those things that we get spoiled about how fast things can go, and now all of a sudden we just want them to be faster and faster. And then it doesn't help that games are getting enormously large. Right. We have a couple of games that are on the cache that are probably 70, 80 gigs each.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of them are around the 50 gig mark. So it's...
Which is huge.
It should take a while. Yeah.
No, yes,
these Steam caches can also, apparently, we didn't configure it. It was a little bit, we didn't figure it out. We don't download from very often, but they can also cache Uplay or Origin games and even Windows updates. So it might be another use case for you there too.
The Windows updates would be tempting. I actually started downloading the Windows updates files separately when there's something big coming down the pike, just to keep myself from going insane. But it's amazing. One of the things about getting a gigabit connection like you have, or we've got a half gig synchronous in the office I'm in right now. I've got, in theory, 75 megabits per second, but in reality, closer to 200 megabits per second at home. And it's, you start to realize exactly how many services are throttled. And you start, for example, in the case of Dropbox, I figured out that using the Dropbox sort of application and folder was considerably faster than using the browser in the office here. And it's, you start to realize like, oh, I can only get 30 megabits out of this. Where's the rest of my speed? Then you start running trace routes and calling tech support and irritating the hell out of them because they're like, we're still dealing with people with DSL that think a megabit up is a good day. And it's like, I don't care.
Yeah.
Make this move faster. Samsung C49HG90 FreeSync 2 monitor. I am a fan of ultra-wide monitors. I've been using an ultra-wide. I bought out of my own pocket a Dell 3415 that I have been using religiously. I got one of the new BenQ ultra-wides in for review. This is a little unhinged.
Even for the sort of crazed programmers and gamers I hang out with, this is 49 inches. This thing is huge.
Yeah.
And it's a little surreal because it's not just ridiculously wide. It's 49 inches diagonally. It's running a 32:9 aspect ratio. So normally, for most of the ultrawide monitors out there, you get a 21:9 or something in that neighborhood. There's various complaining. It doesn't have 1,600 pixels. It only has 1,440 pixels. And I get it. You want your last, 50 pixels, more than 50 pixels. Math is hard. 160 pixels. But math is still hard because I did the calculation the wrong way a second time. But this is very, very wide and very narrow. And part of me thinks this is probably, on the good days, a magnificent gaming experience if you're putting together your battle station and you want to buy one massive monitor. But it is coming at a penalty. it's essentially two 1080p monitors side by side. But somehow it manages to look wider and shorter than two 1080p monitors side by side. Is that just
seems
a
impossible.
Trick of the photos? Yeah.
No. It is a trick of the photos. It's a trick of the design itself, because it does feel that way. But because you don't have the bezel between it, you only have one out of the 2 feet that you would normally have, right? But it is identical. It's 1920x1080x2 displays without a bezel in the middle. But yes, it does come across as extremely wide but pretty squat. It's been a long time
strange.
Since the curve is odd as well, right? So it's so wide that it actually doesn't curve all the way to the ends. Ken wrote that I think the last 6 inches on each side or so, they're actually straight.
That makes no sense to me, because I've used 1700R. Like, I prefer a shallower curvature. An 1800R curvature is pretty
it's pretty
steep. So to see that and then to have them make it super curved and then flatten out the edges, usually you think, when you think curved television and or curved monitor, I'm going to have it really close and it's going to extend out. And I guess they found, either it's a manufacturing issue or they found in testing that having it that curved drove people nuts.
Right.
I mean, it's FreeSync 2. Which is, I guess, how you guys got a hold of it, right? Because there's probably not a lot to test FreeSync 2 with right now. I feel that Ken was not particularly enamored with the experience.
So, yeah, I think from a productivity standpoint, it was interesting. For me, I don't think it makes a lot of sense. I think the height of the monitor is not enough. There's not enough pixels there. But again, I'm using 25x16 panels even. So you're talking about, 50% more pixels in that direction, which is substantial. It does have the capability to have, you can use two inputs simultaneously. So you can have two 1080p inputs going to it. If you wanted to do that, you had two different machines, or you had an Xbox and a PC going through it. That might be kind of interesting. I think there's even one where you can do a 21:9 input and then an even smaller input to one direction as well.
Right.
On the gaming side, I think, the individual game support has actually gotten a lot better for these ultra wides. And in some cases, this is better. And it's definitely better than having two 1080p monitors where there's a bezel between them. No matter how thin the bezels are on whatever displays, this is obviously going to be better than that. Is it better than having three monitors across and doing that? I mean, you're not at the same resolution, but I think you might be getting almost all of the same effect without any of the headaches of bezels at all. So I think there's that. I do think Ken was not really impressed. I don't think any of us in the office were really impressed about the HDR implementation itself. So if you remember, FreeSync 2 is basically the original FreeSync, variable refresh capability. All of that works fine on here. And in fact, I would even wager to say that it works exceedingly well because of it's got a 48 to 144 hertz range on the display port and 48 to 100 hertz on HDMI. So you can do variable refresh on either input. But the HDR implementation is just, you know, subpar. It's using the HDR, where's that at here? It's the HDR, or it's the display HDR 600 certification. So it covers a whole bunch of different stuff in terms that of specifications.
Go ahead. Okay. So, I mean, if it's implemented properly, if it's, that should be 600 nits at peak brightness. It should have a pretty solid color gamut. I mean, because I've seen Dell's, because the Face of Display HDR, you know, we talked about this when that 27-inch Dell came out. That also may just be a better implemented monitor than this is. That's only HDR 400, but the colors were deep, they were saturated, they were bright. I mean, HDR support on monitors is a hot mess.
Yeah, it is. And if you read into the spec, like the HDR 600 certification requires a display to sustain a 10% patch in the center of the screen at a brightness of 600 nits, as well as be able to flash the entire display at the same 600 nits brightness. However, normal full screen long duration backlight brightness only needs to be able to hit 350, which is just a little bit over, you know, the 300 of traditional SDR displays. So it's more of a burstiness to get to that 600 range as opposed to any kind of sustained level.
For the brightness for HDR, but when you look at the color gamut on a lot of the HDR 400 monitors, they actually have a broader color gamut from an HDR perspective than most of the 4K UHD 2017 televisions that were sold last year. So this should actually have a wider color gamut. Whether or not it can actually achieve the same brightness.
I mean, if you look at the spec
brightness.
There, the minimum color gamut is 95% sRGB, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, that's not that substantial, right?
Well, no. Oh, boy. I'm on the wrong.
Hold on. Display 600 is 99% of, or 90% DCI-P3.
Which is significantly greater than a lot of 4K UHD televisions that were sold with HDR support last year. Not as broad, you know, it's amazing, when you start digging into the specs on a lot of the HDR televisions that were sold last year, for example, that relatively inexpensive Dell monitor had a better color gamut, had a broader array of colors, had been, you know, covered more of the color, HDR color palette or the color gamut than most of the televisions that sold for under $1,500 last year. And that's on a relatively inexpensive desktop monitor. I could also argue, in terms of televisions, that Vesa Display 1000, that's the goal for a television. That would be alarmingly bright on a desktop monitor. I'd be curious to see it. It can be, you know, was the backlighting at least consistent? Were the blacks super dark, or was it just kind of a hot mess all over?
No, this is a... it's not an IPS panel, I don't believe. I think it's a VA panel. And then we have a couple of these that are labeled as HDR monitors that are TN panels. We haven't tested yet, but they're in as TN, right? So that's not a good starting point for us to come at it from. So I think having had HDR TVs in here, including 2017 models, this just didn't have the same effect on us, the HDR integration on this. And
will it support?
I think a lot of that is the brightness capability of it, and trying to get sustained high brightness and multi-zone into a smaller form factor, even though this is incredibly wide, but like a smaller monitor form factor.
It was interesting. I mean, I was shocked by the ultra-thin monitor, by how deep the blacks were. And how rich the colors were. And it's funny, it got to be the point where I'm actually picking up a Datacolor Spider 5 just to do some more objective testing on that, because it's pretty impressive to see. That was using Corning Iris glass. And what was interesting about the Iris glass is just exactly how, how even the lighting was, which is always been a problem for entry-level monitors or less expensive monitors. It's a bummer. I don't know. I've That's just a big piece of glass, and I'm actually surprised it sells for as little as it does. He says.
Now, the interesting thing is there's like a 27 inch 25 by 14 version of this panel, like not of this panel, but of this model of this line from Samsung. And I wonder how much different its behavior is, its capability is. You know, is it the panel manufacturing technology so much further ahead on that scale that it's going to be a lot better, or is it going to perform the same basically in our experiencing? So we'll.
It completely depends on the glass they chose.
They're all VA panels, except there's two on the right. There are TN panels in that breakdown that you see. So
it's delightfully old school.
Yeah. Yep.
Oh my goodness. AMD Wraith Prism. Thumbs up. Thumbs down.
So this was interesting. This was the hard OCP. They did an individual kind of write up and review on it. We were really impressed with ours with our 2700X testing and review. They went through it and kind of put it through their normal gamut of testing as if it were a product you could buy. Now it is a quote unquote free product that comes in the box with the new Ryzen 2000 series. So you know, keep that in mind. It's a stock cooler for all of the positives and negatives that you know brings along with it. It didn't do well in the hard OCP testing. Now, I will say the caveat there is at the end of the review, they just found that there were two settings for the fan, a high and a low, and that they had done all the testing on the low setting. So that would have some impact, obviously, on temperatures, but also on temps. I'm sorry, and sound, not just those are the same. So.
Right. But they didn't do any testing on the louder, higher settings.
Yeah, and also if you look at the sound profile graph, it's got a poor scale on it where it starts at 39 instead of 0, so the gaps look a lot larger than they are. The Wraith Prism, for example, they did test that on the high side at 48 decibels, which is 3 higher than Cooler Master or Intermax device, for example. So they didn't come away nearly as impressed with it. I mean, comparing it to a custom made off the shelf, cooler design for overclocking and that type of stuff, it's not going to do that. But I think out of the box, if you're going to do really, really basic overclocking or maybe no overclocking, it offers a lot of looks and style as well as capability there. And again, the cost is free,
right?
Sort of ish.
Comes in the box. Well, it's frustrating because it's amazing the performance you can get out of a $25 or $30 air cooler, which the majority of the price on that is going to be markup. Not to take anything away from companies making a profit. I'm down with making a profit, but. I'm surprised they didn't do additional testing on the higher setting, but I can also understand wanting to test it in the quiet mode that it's supposed to be famous for.
Right.
Yep. I don't know.
Yeah.
I just know that I paid a lot more for my top of the line AMD processor last year than I would have this year. And I think that's awesome.
Good for you, having the positive outlook.
Looking forward to building my next PC with even more computational power. You, Mr. Shrout, which one of this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by the Ring Video Doorbell? Ring's mission, their goal, what they're here to do is to make neighborhoods safer. The Ring Video Doorbell, it's the center, the key, the linchpin. It lets you see and speak to intruders on your smartphone from anywhere, even share video clips with neighbors. Hey, have you seen this guy? Did he knock on your door too? Using the Ring app. And ladies and gentlemen, joining me right now from beautiful Florence, Kentucky, a dedicated Ring owner using a Ring at home and at the office, Mr. Ryan Shrout. Mr. Shrout, can you tell me of an incident where the Ring helped you to secure goods being delivered to your home or protect your business or your family?
Every time, right? I mean, it's... that gives you alerts. Alan has one as well. It gives you alerts when somebody's walking up to your door, so you kind of know, with even if they don't hit the doorbell, that somebody's there. That's nice to have, because very often we have deliveries that are made at the office or at home that are left on the doorstep.
But
they
don't bother to
they don't bother to knock on the door or ring the doorbell. And so it's nice to know that somebody has approached. Or if it's a salesperson, you can go hide in the corner until they stop looking in the windows to see if you're there, for example. There are a lot of obvious and very valuable use cases for that technology.
Just like the Ring Video Doorbell, Floodlight Cam is a motion-activated camera and floodlight that connects to your phone. With high visibility floodlights, HD video, and two-way audio, it lets you know the moment anyone steps on your property. You can see and speak to visitors, even set off an alarm right from your phone. When things go bump in the night, you'll immediately know what it is, which is great. Ring floodlight cams, they offer the ultimate in home security. Thieves just can't hide with Ring, but more importantly, you can tell the difference between a raccoon on the fence in the backyard and somebody trying to break into your garage. And having been sent out to defend the home and family, it would be much nicer to know that it's just a raccoon back there or one of the neighbor's kids trying to figure out a new way to pound on the door, and that you can actually just fire off the alarm and scare the raccoons into the next county. This is crazy. Twitter.com/ringthisvideo. This guy was trying to steal packages off of a porch, and the owner of the house, Vu, was able to call him out, and the guy dropped the package he was trying to steal and ran, all because the owner knew what was going on because of that Ring Video Doorbell. Monitor every corner of your property with a Ring of Security kit, which includes a Ring Video Doorbell and your choice of either 1, 2, or 3 floodlight cams. And connect your Ring Video Doorbell with your favorite smart locks and hubs for added convenience, monitoring, and security. Stop crime before it happens and help make your neighborhood safer with Ring. Save up to $150 on a Ring of Security kit at ring.com/twitch. That's ring.com/twitch. $150 off when you go to ring.com/twitch. And we want to thank Ring for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware.
Very nice.
Man, meet the Intel 3Z390 chipset. Just as soon as you've gotten used to that new AMD chipset, there's a new Intel chipset. And what a block diagram that is, ladies and gentlemen, you're looking at if you're watching the video right now. Are you excited about this, or are you still suffering from the disappointment of watching the 10 nanometer process for Intel's top of the line chips fall yet another 6 to 84 months into the future? Was that cool?
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of, no, it was pretty disappointing. And honestly, there's not a lot here on this chipset that, stands out in terms of things that look or feel new. If you look through, you know, the documents that Intel themselves accidentally posted online, you can see that they talk about PC responsiveness, support for Optane memory, which that was already as a part of things. They do this. This is, I believe, the first time we've seen 802.11ac integrated into the chipset itself for this series of desktop boards. Support for all the display output capabilities, HDR, all of that. But most of this is a representation or is made possible by the chip itself, not the motherboard. Mm-hmm. There's not a whole lot on here that looks different, which I think actually. If it turns out to be the case that you have to have a Z390 motherboard to support the 8-core version of an Intel processor when it comes out, there's going to be a lot of disgruntled people out there. They're going to wonder why, you know, to support the 8700K, you had to have the Z370, and suddenly, you know, within another 8 months, you have to have another motherboard to support the next processor. This has been a pretty bad look for Intel when it comes to its enthusiast platforms and kind of, I don't know, right, planning things out a little bit. There doesn't appear to have been much there. So,
I mean, at this point, are they sort of randomly throwing things against a wall while they wait for the process to sort itself out?
I mean,
is it that bad?
I don't want to oversimplify it that much, but kind of. It really is a, you know, You're presented with a problem. We can't manufacture X, but we can't wait 3 years between products. How can we improve, and in what ways can we improve, and how do we sell a new product, right? Because you got to think about it. It's not just Intel that suffers if they don't sell a new processor. Right. It's motherboard guys that suffer if they can't sell a new motherboard every year, a new family, a new generation. That's their opportunity to innovate, to add new features, launch new brands. The same thing happens with Dell and HP and these guys that sell desktop systems and all-in-ones that go in cadences that markets and businesses and consumers are used to it. If suddenly Intel were to say, nope, we don't have anything new for 2 years, 2.5 years, we're doing you guys a favor by not pushing forward on stuff, they would actually be hurting a substantial portion of the market. Doesn't make it better for enthusiasts that do understand that these differences and if there may be very few of them between them. But, you know, you get a 6-core option out of it, thanks to AMD pressure. Maybe now we get an 8-core part out of it, thanks to AMD pressure, and we all keep driving forward. And if you buy a new system, maybe you got to get a new motherboard. We'll see. They still have, like I said, this is still a leak,
right?
Their own leak. So we don't even know what processor this is going to launch with, and
well, 8th generation when it's going Intel to core processors, Intel
sure, Pentium which processors, is like
Intel Celeron.
The 8th generation of Intel Core processors is basically 50 different parts now, right? Like,
right. And it's been dribbling out for how many months? Years?
Yeah. Yeah.
Decades?
It's becoming problematic. 8th gen
Intel processors as a service. Inspired by Windows 10. I mean, it's
inspired
good, right?
By Microsoft 365.
You know, if Microsoft suddenly decides to bring home theater support back into Windows or add it to Windows 10, right? You'll have 10-bit color, high dynamic range, and Rec 2020 to up to 4K resolutions from the graphics on the motherboard,
right?
Which is awesome. Gigabit transfers on the NIC, wireless AC 9560, integrated Bluetooth 5, all of which I'm delighted by. But I'd like to see a fantastic new chip. Not holding my breath right now.
Yeah.
Look at me. I'm an AMD fanboy. Who knew? Windows 1803 updates don't work with a couple of SSDs, which is probably the great... I joke about Intel dribbling out 8th generation processors as processor as a service, but Windows as a service is kind of awesome when it works, because you keep getting updates to the operating system without having to buy a new operating system every 18 months, years. Sometimes they make changes and your life gets complicated. If you watch us record the show live, you've probably heard us saying really unprintable things. Well, mostly printable things, because we try to be family friendly, but Skype updates, for example, tend to break things and complicate lives. The Windows 10 April 2018 update, had a lot of unusual things. The timeline, which I never really thought I needed, but I'm kind of fascinated by, where I can scroll back weeks worth of my computational history, which can be a little terrifying at times. It broke certain Intel SSDs, and this is kind of a big deal. Intel 600P and Pro 6000P SSDs, not a big deal in the sense of millions of people being impacted, but in the sense that, you know, your SSD, your storage medium, should not be impacted by an update. Windows 10 runs the update. You get a UFI screen after you reboot. And then Microsoft is like, you should reinstall the Fall Creators update, and then install all of the updates you need to update the Fall Creators update with to keep it up to date for security issues. The issue is a specified known incompatibility between the operating system and the SSDs, which were launched in 2016. Both the 600P and Pro 6000P SSDs share the same SM2260 chipset and feature a PCIe NVMe 3.0x4 interface, writes Richard Speed over at theregister.co.uk.
They added some of the selection of Toshiba SSDs had the same problem, apparently.
Whoops.
Yeah, XG4, XG5, BG3 series are suffering for what they call is calling low battery life. So the software maker is taking steps to block the update. That's weird. Anyway, they expect a fix to be emitted sometime in June, which is not that soon.
No, But on the upside, you won't know all of the fancy. I mean, really, what are you missing from the April update? The really cool way of turning off programs and startup that's in the system menu.
Yeah.
You know, the new timeline.
My laptop did its 1803 update in the beginning of meetings on Tuesday, I believe. And when it came back up, my fingerprint reader no longer worked on my ThinkPad. So,
well, it's not like a lot of people use ThinkPads. That's a joke, by the way. Lenovo should be listening.
That didn't work. And also, like, the hardware microphone mute button on the keyboard stopped working. I fixed the fingerprint sensor. There was a thread on Lenovo's forums about after the 1803 update, and the answer was to uninstall the driver and then download this Windows driver and download this Lenovo driver, and it immediately started working again. So, and this would be something that I'm sure, had I waited a week or two more, probably would have been pushed out through, you know, a patch on Tuesday, on a patch Tuesday type thing. But there's a reason I use fingerprint sensor, because my password is exceedingly long, and this is way easier.
It is the danger of Windows as a service, as they, we notice it more in the major iterations, the big evolutionary jumps, not so much in the little evolutionary jumps that happen from month to month, but things break. You know, I've had to reinstall, you know, the drivers for my DAC/ADC at least three times since I started running Windows 10. And I love Windows 10. But I literally had to go to the drivers to get it to run. I had to go to the drivers for the second generation product, not the first generation product. And I've had to reinstall them twice. Makes no sense. Hardware voodoo. But it works when I do that, which again makes no sense. But I had an interesting question on Tech Thing this week. We got kind of in depth on it and talking about performance improvements. But one of our viewers, his daughter has a 1-year-old laptop, and it's been running at 100% hard drive, or the hard drive's been running at 100%, you know, 24/7, 365. And I felt a special sympathy for this because, A, I have children using computers at home, and B, I've actually seen a hard drive hit 100% due to a Windows error, because he was wondering if upgrading from the hard disk drive that came in the laptop to an SSD would solve the problem. And it probably wouldn't, unless they did a complete freshening, like cloning it probably wouldn't fix it. But moving it to doing a fresh Windows install might actually fix it in the process of upgrading the hard drive to an SSD. You know, it's most likely, if you are seeing a computer with a 100%, where the hard disk drive is trapped at 100%, once you make sure it's not some sort of malware, it's probably Windows search just running, or a Superfetch issue. I think Windows search is more common. Make Use of has a great article that walks you through the steps of diagnosing this, but it's amazing how things that are designed to make your computer run faster, if they go sideways for some particular reason, can actually make your computer incredibly slow. But I thought that was worth mentioning. Also, because I just want to say, if you have a hard drive, a traditional rotating hard drive in your computer that your operating system and applications run off of, upgrading that to an SSD will be maybe not a life-changing experience, but will yield, you know, more bang for the buck than just about any upgrade you could do to a computer. You know, unless you're, you know, a 3D gamer that's been using the onboard graphics on a GPU and you go to like a 1050 or 1060.
That would be significant.
Yeah, that would be pretty amazing. But I was thinking about that the other day because I have two computers left. One of them is kind of a server, but the other one is an all-in-one that has like a 5-year-old hard drive inside of it. And I keep thinking, you know, at some point I'm going to throw an SSD in this and this computer is completely going to change. So just something to think about. I don't know. A lot of people looking to make their hardware last longer these days. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. The mortgage experience, emotionally traumatic, crushing, boring, painful. staggeringly old school. It wasn't keeping up with the times. It was dated. It needed a client-focused technological revolution, which is why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan, because finally, you understand what's going on. It's simple. Allows you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Not the one they're trying to sell. Not the one the website says, you should do this one because we make the most money. Oops, did I say that out loud? No. Rocket Mortgage is trying to get you the best possible mortgage for you. The trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. It's powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in seconds, which is so much better than guesstimating with a napkin. Based on your income, your assets, your credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of the home loan options for which you qualify and find the one that's just right for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/twit. That's rocketmortgage.com/twit. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org number 3030. We want to thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. If only everything could be updated to make my life easier. Just saying. I have goals. Just make everything easier for me. Corsair's Obsidian 1000D Super Power PC case. You know, I tend to do understated cases. A lot of black, a lot of metal, often smaller, occasionally with stacks of optical drive access in the front. This thing looks like a disco on Friday night, though. 18 cooling fan mounts, up to four 480 millimeter radiators. This is crazy. And when I say crazy, I mean kind of awe-inspiring and terrifying. You know, and I'd like to point out that, props to Jeremy for fighting his way through this. What's going on with this thing? I mean, is this the supercar of cases?
I mean, kind of. You remember the Corsair 900D, right? It was their first case, I believe. It wasn't. I think the 800D was their first. But the 900D was this enormous behemoth of a chassis. This is the 1000D. It goes well beyond that. 12 by 27 by 27 inches, it's essentially, huge. Give or take. Yeah,
and I have a computer at home right now with 7 optical drives in it. And I'm looking at this and going, this thing's huge. Sorry.
It has enough room in there for a full-size EATX and a mini ITX system simultaneously. You can install up to four 480 millimeter radiators or mixed solutions, obviously. It has, that picture with the fans is tremendous. You use their Corsair IQ software so you can sync it all up or do whatever patterns you want to do with it. It's not cheap, but it's also not out of this world expensive. It's $500 or so. I love the fact that the back panels open the way it does to support, you know, 6 SSDs. The power supplies mount in a unique way. They don't just sit under the motherboard in some boring fashion. It's an impressive device. I think we're going to get one in to review on this. I don't know where we're going to put it, but you know, sometimes you got to make sacrifices.
You know, I just want you guys to get 18 fans rolling in this thing.
Oh Lord. Those fans that they're using in that picture are their top end. I forget what they're called, RGB fans. Obviously, I don't think the case ships with all of that. So I bet that's several hundred dollars worth of fans. Because if you look, there's
$300 worth of fans inside.
Yeah,
of there.
Yeah, yeah. So that's that gives you an idea. Yeah,
just gotta dedicate yourself to having a superior battle station. Unfortunately, that 49-inch monitor is not living up to the standards of your superior battle station. So maybe we could do a 4K projector.
That put it on top, have it come out the window, something like that.
I like it. Or a short throw projector. It's kind of frightening to contemplate. Bitcoin, from the ridiculous and upsetting statistics desk at PCPer, actually at sell.com, Bitcoin is using nearly as much power as the nation of Ireland. Now, this might be a good thing because Ireland's not a particularly big nation, but that's still a lot of power.
So this was like a research paper done by this group trying to evaluate the electricity usage of Bitcoin. The Bitcoin network itself can be estimated to consume 2.5 gigawatts of electricity currently, with potential to hit 7.67 gigawatts in the future, making it comparable with countries such as Ireland, which is 3.1 gigawatts, and Austria, 4.8 billion which is people. 8.2. Economic models tell us Bitcoin's electricity consumption will gravitate toward the latter number. A look at Bitcoin miner production estimates suggest this number could already be reached in 2018. So we're not talking about like 5 years in the future, talking about, you know, 7 months or so. I have no other commentary on this other than just continue to be flabbergasted. We were talking about this before in the office about like, yeah, obviously this is a statistical model. This is not a direct measurement and obviously can't correct, you know, 100% accurately predict what the power consumption is going to be, but you can get a pretty good idea based on prevalence of different computing hardware, whether or not they're using GPUs or ASIC miners or whatever. It's not a small amount, right? And I saw that, you know, even when we were doing some of that stuff here, and you'd see all of a sudden you get a $800 or $900 electric bill, and like, oh wow! And this was, you know, just a handful of PCs that did it for 1 month or something. It's not great. It's not great. And I think, you know, I've seen some stories about cities in the United States or in Canada that are near hydroelectric areas, right? And they were setting up shop there, buying warehouses or setting up, you know, tractor trailers full of this stuff, and then the city and the residents of the city trying to kick these people out because they were sucking away all of the power they had and legitimately causing like brownouts in those areas. So
awkward.
Maybe not as big as issue in the U.S. because of the infrastructure, but you look at China, India, those areas that that might have problems with it. It's an interesting statistic to look at.
I'd be curious to see what that number looks like next year if, you know, Bitcoin continues to fall and Ethereum mining kind of stays at or drops at the level it's been for a while. It's just a crazy amount of electricity. OnePlus 6 is coming up. I know Shannon's really excited because the OnePlus 5 turned out to be a pretty good phone for the money. OnePlus was really awkward for the first few models they sold. And I say that because it was awkward to try to review them if you didn't have a review unit because you had to have an invitation to buy the phone, which can be really difficult. But they've... you know, there's a really nice write-up on Digital Trends that kind of walks you through what's going on there. So, you know, what happens, though, is when they come out with a new model, they basically stop making the previous model. So that they only have one phone going on at a time. And what's been interesting about them is, A, they like doing special edition phones, and B, they tend to give you flagship features at a lower price than the competition. And, the first special edition they're doing, should you be an Avengers fan, prepare to clean up and pee from your enthusiastic, you know, dog-like response to this. The Avengers Infinity War Edition. Quote, I'm gonna quote Christian DeLuper from Digital Trends here. made to celebrate the blockbuster movie with the same name. OnePlus collaborates with its partners in the right way by adding more than just a few wallpapers and a special box, and this version proves it. However, it's not going to be easy to buy, as so far the phone has only been announced for China so far. But if you look at it, if you get a close-up of that picture, you basically have Iron Man's face in carbon fiber, in the rear panel. Nice. Not Tony Stark, but the actual Iron Man suit. Complete with a gold OnePlus, an Avengers logo, and a gold alert slider on the side. I like OnePlus. I just think special editions of phones are kind of goofy by nature, but I can think of at least three people I know that would kind of get giddy about this.
Right.
There will be one of six randomly inserted Avengers medals inside the box, which means you might have to buy several dozen OnePlus 6s to complete your collection of the medals, which OnePlus would probably be delighted by, and are certainly encouraging because there's a competition, a prize for the person that collects all six. So
wow.
Yeah,
I didn't notice that part. No
for
thanks.
A mere $30 more than the regular OnePlus 6. But
specification wise, it's interesting to note this is a Snapdragon 845 processor, 6 or 8 gigs of memory, up to 256 gigs of internal storage. It does not have microSD slot on it, so the kind of internal storage matters a little bit more. Screen resolution, a 2280 by 1080. It does support GSM CDMA and LTE, but does not work on Verizon or Sprint in the US still.
Which makes no sense to me. I'm also, it seems to be a little on the long side, a little on the thin side. How do you feel about the notch, the cutout at the top of the phone where the speaker and the camera are? Because it's, I've been watching people, you know, I'm using relatively dated phone technology, so anything with a screen that big and that bright looks kind of fascinating to me. does the notch kind of kill you from an aesthetic standpoint, or are you okay with it?
No. To be fair, I have an iPhone 10, and I don't really, it doesn't bother me anymore. It's dumb. I don't think it needs to exist. I don't think the real estate to the sides of it are particularly useful because they've crammed stuff up in there that I liked having more detail in previously. Right. But it's not the end of the world. If you make it smaller and you can have more detailed notifications and icons and stuff up there, then fine. Eventually we'll figure out a way to move past this, have screens that can go over that, but yet still have camera and audio and stuff pass through it. You know, something like that will occur in my lifetime at the very least. so no, I wouldn't say it's a killer for me.
Right. Fingerprint sensor on the back, facial recognition through the front camera, not maybe as secure as you might want if you're a person that worries about security. Dual rear-facing cameras, 16-megapixel sensor, optical image stabilization, and an aperture of f1.7. Secondary sensor is also running at an f-stop of 1.7, 20 megapixels. They're claiming they're going to have a better portrait mode. I was not particularly impressed by the portrait mode on the 5T, although the photography, low light photography, was pretty good. 4K, 60 frames per second, stop motion, 720p video, 240 frames per second for up to a minute, which is kind of crazy. 720p video at 240 or 480 frames per second. Video editing feature built in. Earbuds, which probably suck less than the earbuds from a lot of other phone manufacturers. Not a bad price. 64 gigabytes of storage, 6 gigs of RAM for $530, 8 gigs of RAM, and 128 gigabytes of storage for $580. As Ryan pointed out, there is no micro SD card slot. So buy all the storage you think you're going to need. If you want to go really nuts, and I'm actually, as somebody who has 112 gigabytes of a 128 gigabyte phone filled right now, they do have a 8 gigabyte version of the phone with 256 gigabytes of storage for $630, which is less than I paid for the phone in my pocket that is several years old now. So OnePlus is going to be selling the phone starting on May 22nd. And the silk white version, very special silk white version, will not be available until June 5th. So you excited? Yep. You feeling it? You getting a new phone?
I would like to try it out, but I make no commitments.
I'll be very curious to see what the camera performance looks like. Yep. So, the box, I'm excited. The box for this arrived yesterday. So I'm in the process of updating it and starting to load stuff onto it. Synology has a new NAS, the DS1618 Plus.
Does it hold 16 drives or 18 drives?
Neither. It holds six. At some point, when you get very, very enthusiastic or very, very bored, I will walk you through the naming schema that determines the numbers for this Synology, NASs. It's a new thing for them. Basically, I think the 5-drive NASs are going to fall away. The 6-drive NASs will stay. And I'm very curious to see what the performance looks like, because I have an older 8-bay Synology NAS at home. And this thing's running a quad-core processor, 4 gigabytes of DDR4 memory. You can bump that up to 32 gigabytes, which I find deeply fascinating, because I tend to write large video files all the time to NASs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can add additional Synology, what they call their DX517. Those are expansion units. So this will actually support up to 16 drives. So you basically keep adding enclosures and another 2 enclosures and add additional storage to it. They're claiming, quote, over 1,550 megabytes per second reading and 500 megabytes per second writing, which is nothing to sneeze at as far as I'm concerned. And they can add an optional 10 gigabit Ethernet add-on card. So, you know, and it's got the usual stuff. 4 built-in gigabit RJ45 ports, failover, link aggregation supports, and I'm really curious to see what running the Synology operating system feels like on this. This would be a fairly advanced home NAS or small business NAS. Probably not something you want to do if you want to transcode a lot of 4K, but in terms of backing up all the files and streaming all the files, this has a lot of potential as far as I'm concerned. So more next week after I get some numbers on that. I'm very, 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 very curious to see what the performance looks like on that. Did you see something on, was it the Surface Hub 2?
Yeah, so this is the last thing up there. This is one of those technologies that I see the videos of and the descriptions of and find incredibly fascinating, but I have less faith that it will be implemented in the way that I expected it to be implemented. So keeping in mind, this is the second generation of this. Microsoft had the Surface Hub that they released last year. It was a 1080p 55-inch and a 4K 84-inch screen option that was basically, you know, computing capability in large format touchscreen. This is the same idea. They've simplified it to a single design. So one 50.5-inch display with what they are just saying now is greater than 4K resolution, 3 to 2 aspect ratio, very thin bezels. And if you see some of the videos that they have here, mm-hmm. the screen looks amazing. The way that it adjusts from portrait to landscape very easily is awesome. The way you can combine, you know, 4 of them on a wall, Microsoft calls it tiling, and you can work on one Surface Hub 2 with 2 different workloads. If people are standing side by side, they can both interact with it slightly differently. It sounds pretty interesting, and that Verge story kind of clearly summarizes it in that what the Surface Hub 2 is, it kind of shows what Microsoft's vision of productivity will be in the future. Now, how far in the future is the question I would always ask, right? But it's something they plan on selling. This is not a prototype or some development project they're getting started on. It's just all this software running on top of it that I think will be maybe less sexy than the videos have it look. If it's just a 50-inch Word document that I get to draw on with a pen on the wall, I think that's less exciting. But this is the kind of thing that gets mounted to the wall instead of a mirror, right? It's got a camera, so you can use it as a mirror. It's got a camera, so you can use it for communication and productivity and whatnot. Maybe not as useful at your desk, but you never know. Very cool stuff. I was trying to find a price, and they didn't say price. They said Microsoft claims pricing will be in line with similar competitive devices. And The Verge says that could mean we'll see a more aggressive price point to counter Google's own digital whiteboard. But that still didn't give me a price point. So,
I was going to say aggressive compared to what?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
It's such a relative concept. I don't know. And that's also one of the things where the demos always look so spectacular.
And, yeah. Google's whiteboard is $5,000 apparently as of last year. Okay. So
interesting. It's pretty. I like it. It has an aesthetic.
I really need four of them like that and one on an easel. And that's how I think that's the only way to get true peak productivity out of me going forward.
And then you won't have to worry about building that gigantic Corsair case with 473 mm-hmm. LED fans inside of it because you won't have room for it your workspace anymore.
It's perfect.
Crafty. He's thinking ahead, people. Optimizing productivity by avoiding work, by filling his workspace with gigantic interactive whiteboards. Beyond
whatever,
that,
anything.
Anything. Anything, anything. Oh, my goodness. PCPro.com is the website where you can find the work of Mr. Brian Trout, Alan Alventano, Ken, and the whole crew. They're working hard, so you don't buy something and think to yourself, my goodness, this was a waste of my time and energy, which I appreciate. On behalf of everyone who reads PCPro, including myself, thank you, gentlemen, for making that effort. It's good stuff. I'm also getting excited. You know, remember at the top of the show with the thing with the GPUs that were affordable again? Mm-hmm, finally going to get to build that S4 mini case. I have the new one, so I'm very excited about that. Haven't figured out how to put 8 optical drives inside of it, but that's okay. I'll just hide those.
Let me know
somewhere.
How that goes.
It's going to go miserably. It's going to be really frustrating. But maybe I can put them in that case with the hard drive that's, you know, currently being sort of a server in the corner. But you can find me over at techthing.com, TEKTHING.com, or AVXL, which is AVEXCEL, the podcast I host with Mr. Robert Heron that talks about home theater and audio. And of course, Tech Thing is our weekly adventure in technology that Shandon and I do. I'm actually really excited to run some tests on that the new Synology NAS. I'm kind of really curious about that one. And I will also say I'm looking forward to Maker Faire this weekend. So if you want to see what the new shiny is. Yeah, it was cool. And I've got some headphone reviews coming up because I'm constantly reviewing headphones, including the Neurophones, which are Australian, $400, and measure your eardrum, or actually they measure an acoustic response from a signal that's vibrated against your eardrum. And then things get really crazy. That's not even the crazy part. So those will be coming up in the near future. Also some reasonably priced hardware, which is a big plus. Memory, still expensive. GPUs, cheap. Eighth generation Intel processors trickling out. AMD stable laptops, very affordable. It's amazing what you can get for a $500 laptop. That's what we were talking about on Tech Thing this week. And Mr. Ryan Trout, not traveling this week. It was a delight to have you. Is there anything you can tease that's coming up on PC Per?
I don't know. We'll see. We did get a 2-socket Epic server in. But I don't know if you've tried to price, I don't know, 192 gigs of DDR4 memory recently.
Oh,
but it's pretty high. It's pretty high.
It's worth slightly less than my truck. But only because my truck has a really nice transmission in it.
We need ECC memory, so we'll have to increase that price a little bit. But yeah.
How much is 192 gigabytes of ECC?
I don't know yet. No one's going to tell me because they know I won't buy it. So,
well, it's not like it's what? It's a $2,300 processor?
No.
One of the less expensive. $3,500
processors. Yeah. And I'm almost that much in memory, probably, is my guess.
What's going to really piss me off is when you turn this into a Plex server.
Right. Faster transcodes
here. We decided we wouldn't be able to serve 4K transcodes to the entire city of Florence, Kentucky, simultaneously. Mm-hmm, oh, my goodness. I'm curious to see. Are you guys going to test this as a workstation or as an actual server?
No, server.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure we'll probably do some of both, but primarily server.
because how could you resist? Let's fire up exactly. Premiere and see how long it takes to render. Speaking of applications that really need to back off on the updates that slow things down, not that I'm bitter and angry about that. Oh, my goodness. Ladies and gentlemen, this has been This Week in Computer Hardware, a.k.a. Twitch. You can find all of our older episodes and information on how to subscribe at twit.tv/Twitch. That is the place, ladies and gentlemen. And again, you can find Mr. Ryan Shroud at PC Purr. You can find me at TechThing or AVXL.com. And you, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you will join us next week when we will be talking about things that we cannot currently name because they are super secret. And lawyers will drop from the sky with rage and paperwork in their hands if we talk about them this week. So with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Trout.
See you next week on Twitch.